What if your boss told you to drop everything and go catch the waves? In 1970, while most American companies were installing time clocks and monitoring bathroom breaks, a small climbing equipment shop in Ventura, California, posted a radical policy. When the surf's good, everyone can leave. The blacksmith-turned-businessman behind this decision wasn't trying to build an empire. He just wanted to make better gear and spend more time outdoors. Yet this simple philosophy, that work should bend around life, not the other way around, became the foundation of Patagonia, a company that would challenge every assumption about how business should operate. Decades later, while corporate scandals dominate headlines and climate change accelerates, this unconventional approach has created not just a profitable enterprise, but a blueprint for capitalism with a conscience. The Patagonia story begins in a forge, not a boardroom. Throughout the 1960s, Chouinard hammered out climbing pittance by hand, working just enough to fund his next climbing trip. He and his friends lived in vans, paid themselves hourly wages, and operated from basement apartments. Their business model was beautifully simple: create the best equipment possible, keep costs low, and prioritize time in the mountains over money in the bank. By 1970, they'd become America's largest climbing hardware supplier. But success brought an uncomfortable revelation. Their most popular product, the steel piton, was scarring the rock faces they loved. Climbers were literally destroying what they cherished most. The decision they made next would define everything that followed. They phased out their best-selling item and developed aluminum chocks that left no trace. Their 1972 catalog boldly promoted this clean climbing approach, essentially telling customers to stop buying what made them the most profit. Older climbers resisted initially, but the market shifted. Sometimes doing the right thing actually works. The clothing business emerged accidentally. Chouinard brought back corduroy from England for climbing shorts, then discovered rugby shirts in Scotland that prevented hardware slings from cutting his neck. These colorful garments stood out against drab military surplus. As demand grew for rain gear and backpacks, they needed a distinct identity: Patagonia, evoking windswept peaks and untamed wilderness. Early missteps were inevitable. When Backpacker magazine reviewed their first backpacks, the verdict was brutal. How well would you expect ironmongers to sew? But they learned and persisted. What began as a blacksmith serving fellow climbers evolved into a global company, yet the core remained unchanged: passionate outdoor enthusiasts making gear for people like themselves. Their culture traces back to those early days where climbers designed gear for themselves and friends. There was no division between users and makers. Their first hiring principle remains: as many employees as possible should be true customers. They don't think like customers, they are customers who get upset when products disappoint and feel proud when they excel. Though today's employees have diverse beliefs, this environmental commitment and aversion to hierarchy remains their DNA. They seek collaborative ensemble players, actively recruiting dirtbags who feel more at home in base camp than offices, believing it's easier to teach outdoor enthusiasts business skills than to instill wilderness passion in business people. Walk into most clothing stores and you'll find garments designed to look good on hangers. Patagonia does the opposite: solve a real problem, then worry about aesthetics. This function-first philosophy traces to Shoe Weinard's blacksmithing days, when a tool either worked or it didn't. In the early 1980s, they revolutionized mountain wear by replacing cotton, wool, and down with synthetic pile that insulated when wet and dried quickly. Their first pile garments were admittedly ugly, stiff fabric originally intended for toilet seat covers, but performed so brilliantly that climbers overlooked aesthetics. They pioneered layering systems: moisture-wicking inner layers, insulating middle layers, protective outer shells. When polypropylene melted easily and retained odors, they developed Capilene polyester. Durability forms another cornerstone, directly challenging fashion's planned obsolescence. Patagonia products are designed to be repaired and last decades. Their design philosophy embraces simplicity because complexity usually signals unresolved problems. When they discovered their cotton contained harmful pesticides, they switched entirely to organic cotton, despite costs initially tripling. They pioneered recycled polyester for chinchilla fleece, accepting temporary quality compromises for long-term environmental benefits. This commitment creates unusual customer loyalty. While most brands rely on marketing to generate demand, Patagonia builds products so exceptional that customers become evangelists. Creating exceptional products without owning factories requires discipline. Patagonia's production philosophy rests on six principles. Designers collaborate directly with producers using simple sketches. They build deep, long-term supplier relationships instead of chasing low bids. They prioritize quality over schedules and cost. A loose button discovered by a customer represents complete system failure. They take calculated risks only after thorough preparation. They invest in prevention during initial samples when options remain open. And they borrow ideas from unlikely sources, even studying McDonald's for lessons on consistent delivery. Most outdoor companies rely on wholesale distribution, but Patagonia diversified through four channels: wholesale to dealers, company-owned stores, mail order catalogs, and internet sales. When wholesale declines during recessions, direct sales often thrive. Their catalog serves as their soapbox, transmitting philosophies directly to customers with an ideal balance of 55% product, 45% environmental message. They entered retail because specialty shops weren't properly displaying their clothing. After their Seattle store opened, wholesale sales to area dealers increased 21% annually, proving retail boosted rather than stole dealer business. Patagonia's image emerges directly from founders' and employees' values. It can't be reduced to formula without destroying authenticity. They replaced corny catalog photos with images from customers showing real people doing real things. They maintain strict standards. No staged shots with models posing as athletes, no cultural appropriation, no safe weekend warriors. Instead, they show climbers picnicking on rusted Chevys, skiers face-planting in powder, activists in action. From the beginning, they've portrayed women as equals, leading climbs rather than following. Their written communication features field reports by writers like Paul Theroux and environmental essays by thought leaders like Bill McKibben. Patagonia follows three distinctive guidelines: inspire and educate rather than promote, earn credibility rather than buy it, and advertise only as a last resort. They spend less than 1% of sales on advertising, typically for environmental awareness rather than product promotion, creating powerful connections with customers who share their values. Their famous "Let My People Go Surfing" flex time policy embodies this authenticity. Employees can catch waves, go bouldering, or be home for their children as long as work gets done. Benefits include comprehensive health insurance, even for part-timers, and on-site childcare from 8 weeks through kindergarten. Though they subsidize the center with $600,000 annually, it helps retain skilled employees in a workforce that's 71% women. Since replacing an employee costs about $50,000, the investment makes financial sense. While most companies prioritize shareholders, Patagonia believes businesses are fundamentally responsible to their resource base, the environment. Their mission statement says nothing about making a profit, but they consider profit a vote of confidence from customers. To lead by example, they must be profitable. It's okay to be eccentric if you're rich, otherwise you're just crazy. This translates into specific practices: remaining privately owned, growing only when customers demand more product, striving to be the best small company rather than a big one, aiming for zero debt, and practicing transparent accounting. Their 1991 crisis tested this perspective. After years of rapid growth, recession caused dealers to cancel orders and inventory to build up. On Black Wednesday, July 31, 1991, they laid off 120 employees, 20% of their workforce. Chouinard and top managers traveled to the real Patagonia to rethink their business, forming their first board of directors and crafting a value statement emphasizing environmental awareness and product quality over fashion. Their turnaround was swift, becoming more focused and recommitting to measuring success by environmental threats averted rather than profits alone. Patagonia's environmental commitment began when employees attended a city council meeting to protect their surf break from the Ventura River's channelization. A graduate student's presentation revealed the dead river actually supported diverse wildlife, defeating the development plan and proving grassroots efforts work. They began donating to small environmental groups, eventually committing 1% of sales or 10% of pre-tax profits annually, whichever was greater. Their boldest move came in 1996, when they switched entirely to organic cotton. Conventional cotton occupies less than 3% of farmland, but consumes 25% of insecticides and 10% of pesticides worldwide, chemicals originally formulated as warfare nerve gases. Switching required rebuilding their entire supply chain and accepting triple the fabric costs, but succeeded both environmentally and financially. In 2001, Shunard co-founded the 1% for the Planet Alliance, now including over 400 businesses. Between 1985 and 2005, Patagonia donated $22 million to environmental causes. They also hold Tools for Grassroots Activists conferences, teaching organizational skills to small groups. Their philosophy supports civil democracy, historically America's most powerful social force. To change government, we must first change corporations, and to change corporations, we must change ourselves as consumers. Americans' consumption rate would require 7 Earths if adopted globally. Patagonia's experiment proves capitalism's endless growth model drives environmental destruction. The results are encouraging. Organic food grows 20% annually, and organic cotton demand tripled since Patagonia's 1996 switch. Farmers and manufacturers who followed created new revenue streams while costs decreased. Nike and Levi's now use organic cotton. The conventional American dream treats companies as disposable. Build fast, cash out quick. When you envision a company outliving its founders, all decisions change. Owners become stewards of culture, assets, and employees. Patagonia prepares for a locally based economy, recognizing global production becomes unsustainable as shipping costs approach material and labor costs. They're pursuing cradle-to-cradle responsibility, products from infinitely recyclable materials that incentivize maximum durability. Revolution requires all of us, leaders, employees, consumers, to participate. We can't reform industries alone, but we can align choices with values and encourage others to follow. In a world where corporations wield unprecedented power, the question isn't whether business should address environmental crisis, it's whether we'll support those leading the way. Every purchase is a vote. Every job is a choice. Every company proves doing good and doing well aren't opposites. They're the same thing, if you're brave enough to try.